Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Katie Payne. Payne is a lifelong naturalist and researcher in the bioacoustics research program at Cornell's Lab of Ornithology. She began her career studying the evolving songs of the humpback whale, but in 1984 she shifted her focus to elephants, and in 1999 she founded the world-renowned Elephant Listening Project. Although she has retired as leader of the project as of 2006, she remains a key player in the organization. She is also author of Silent Thunder in the Presence of Elephants. And welcome to the show, Katie.
Thank you, Tish.
Now, you've described yourself in some interviews that I've read that as a lifelong nature lover. Tell us how you acquired that love of nature as a child.
Oh, I suppose I was born with it. Yeah, I grew up locally on a farm not far from Teganic Falls, and lived outdoors. Spent my teenage disliking junior high school and playing in Teganic. Uh-huh. Marveling at the ancientness of the place, you know. Our fossils are 300 to 400 million years old. The falls is perhaps 20,000 years old. There's so much evidence of glaciers in these valleys. And eventually I came to realize that mammoths and mastodons were living in this place before people were. Mm-hmm. So all through my life, I've been just fascinated by things on all scales.
Yeah, this is a great place to be fascinated by nature, that's for sure. Now, you actually studied music as an undergrad at Cornell. What drew you to music? I know you've said that you're fascinated by sound.
Yes, I just love music. So I didn't study music with any vision of becoming a performing musician. I had started too late and wasn't really talented enough, but I just love music. Mm-hmm. And I suppose living in this quiet, beautiful place, have always listened to nature as music, and music as an aspect of human nature.
Uh-huh. And so did studying music attune you to the eventual job that you took as working in bioacoustics? What aspects of music were you actually studying?
Oh, I was studying everything I could get hands on. Cornell, I went to Cornell as an undergrad, and it had a wonderful faculty. Maybe some of these people are still known. Donald Grout was a teacher, and he conducted us in Bach's St. Matthew Passion a number of times, which is where I met my husband, actually. And as for being a biologist, that came naturally, although I didn't realize at first how much I could learn from other people. Mm-hmm. So it was just sort of slopping around and doing what I felt like.
Uh-huh. That's wonderful. It's wonderful that you've been able to do that because you've been so successful. Now, you began as a whale biologist. Tell us what intrigued you about the whales.
I married Roger Payne, who was playing cello in that same piece when I was singing it the second time. So he was a musical biologist, and we quickly reproduced and had four children. And while I was in the process of bringing those kids up, we took a little trip to Bermuda where we knew there was a whale biologist, or actually a geologist who knew something about whales. He took us out to sea. We had a vision of finding out something about them. Nothing was known except by people in the whaling industry at that time.
What was the time frame?
It was 1969. Mm-hmm. And on that very first trip, Frank Watlington, the Navy engineer who allowed us to accompany him on a Navy trip, said at the end of the trip, "Don't suppose you've heard the sounds these animals make, have you?"
Uh-huh.
We went down into the bowels of the ship, and there Frank put headphones on us, and we heard the most extraordinary series of sounds I've ever heard in my life. Those became the first piece on the recording people can still get called Songs of the Humpback Whale.
Yeah, and Judy Collins actually used that in one of
her
songs, didn't she? Yeah.
She used a recording we made on March 13, 1970, off the shores of Bermuda. But at that time, we realized that whales are singing long, complex songs, repeating patterns of sound that it was males that sing, that their songs were kind of like bird songs, except very extended and very magnificent and huge. And then I began to, while caring for the children, to listen to a series of tapes that Frank gave us that went back 10 years. And I realized those songs were continually and gradually changing in quite complex ways. That shows that whales were learning from one another, imitating one another, leading one another, and were jazz musicians. Continually inventing something new.
You know what I'm curious about? Why did you end up calling them songs and compositions as opposed to just communications?
Well, a song, in biological definition, for instance, for birds or frogs, is a pattern of sounds that repeats almost exactly over and over again. So the remarkable thing about the whale songs was that this would be true for a month at a time, but all the time the material was gradually shifting and changing.
Yeah, and you say, you've said in some of the studies I've read that the sound travels these amazing distances.
Yes, the whale songs, the whale sounds travel really amazing distances. Roger, my husband, figured out with some fancy-brained acoustic mathematician friends that the sounds of the fin whale and I think the blue whale would have traveled 11,000 miles. These are very simple, low, powerful calls, but before the ocean was polluted with human noise. There's no ocean basin that large. So we knew that these sounds were tremendously important. And in the case of those whales, they don't have fixed breeding places. So for them to find their mates, they really had to be listening in the ocean.
Well, that's remarkable. Now, let's go back to what you just said about the human noises that are traveling all through the ocean now. Is it impossible to record the way that you did in the late 60s?
You can still record the way we did. But when you think of it from the point of view of the listening whale, you know that the range over which he or she is hearing other whales is greatly, greatly reduced by the noise of ship's traffic.
That would be something I would never have thought of. That's
oh, it's a
quite
very
something to be disturbed
form
about.
Of pollution, noise pollution, and of course in the ocean, where sound travels so very well, it's the most severe problem, and particularly because these animals can't see very far, so their communication is acoustic. This is how they find their mates and each other, and probably manage their migration patterns.
Now, in 1984, on a kind of a whim, you got introduced to the elephants. You went to the zoo in Oregon, is that true?
That's true. Well, it was a consequence of the 20 years I had spent studying whale song. I'd been recognized as the discoverer of a form of cultural evolution, that is to say, change in learned behavior. And, of course, we associate that with humans, but at that time, it was not associated with very many animals. So I went west to participate in a symposium, a little gathering of people talking about animals that learn from each other. Quite fascinating. And I guess I had some time on my hands, and I heard that some baby elephants had been born from several mothers simultaneously in the Portland, Oregon Zoo, which was then called the Washington Park Zoo, called the director of the zoo. This is the sort of thing I never do, but I did. And he said, sure, come on over and have a look at these animals. And so I sat for a week next to a cage of elephants. And while I was there, I felt a throbbing in the air every now and then. It didn't seem to be associated with any sounds I was hearing. The zoo is a very noisy place, and yet I associated it with a sort of feeling you have when you're in the presence of a very loud, very low-pitched sound, rock band or jet plane taking off or something like that. Actually, you also feel that feeling if the windows in your car are rolled on wrong. You get those pressure changes. Anyway, in the course of the week, I realized it really was associated with elephants. And then I thought, well, maybe elephants are making noises so low-pitched that human ears don't perceive them.
I'm surprised that you could hear it with all the chaos of the... I remember the zoo noise that one always hears.
I didn't hear anything.
But you felt it.
I felt it. Uh-huh. And so the text of the discovery was a feeling and a guess, a hunch. And I came back to Ithaca. I had just moved here, but I happened to know Carl Hopkins and Bob Capronica, who were both acoustic biologists at Cornell. And they said, well, for Lord's sake, we never thought of looking down there for animal sounds. We didn't think there was an animal big enough to make sounds below what humans could hear. Here, take our wonderful expensive equipment and see what you get if you go back to the zoo.
So you did. I was gonna ask you, how did you translate your visit to the zoo into a real study?
Well,
so you got the equipment and went back to the same zoo?
We were kindly given tickets, myself, Bill Langbauer, and Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, whom some listeners may recognize as the author of The Hidden Life of Dogs, wonderful, both friends of mine, and recorded for a month. And we were recording the behavior of the animals as well as recording sounds, whether we could hear them or not.
Uh-huh. And did you discover, because you started out with baby elephants, so did you stay there long enough to watch them grow up? Did the vibrations change as they got older?
Oh, not at all. We were there for 1 month, and we were complete neophytes even about the behavior of the animals, so we were just keeping notes on everything we could see. But it turned out that that we were lucky enough to discover that there's a whole range of communication people hadn't known about. You know, if you make a recording and then you speed it up after it's recorded, the pitch of everything you've recorded will go up. And so that brought it into hearing range. So we could very quickly demonstrate for ourselves and others that this existed.
And so did you find behaviors connected to the different vibrations? Were you able to finally...
Well, a little teeny bit.
Mating sounds anger or...
Nothing as fancy as that. Mm-hmm. But we just discovered that the elephants were making sounds. We were not recording at real speed. And then immediately we were very, very interested because a very low frequency sound travels much better than higher frequency sounds, much farther. And there was a lot of evidence from folks who had been studying elephants in the field that they coordinate their social behavior over long distances, but nobody knew how they did it. And so,
amazing.
You know, lucky me, within a month, I found myself in Amboseli Park in Africa, in Kenya, working with Joyce Poole, who was also very interested in elephant communication, but hadn't realized that there was this other hidden from humans dimension.
Mm-hmm. And what else did you discover about elephants? You obviously love them at this point. What did you discover about their characters?
Well, as is pretty well known by now, elephants are extremely social and very sensitive and very variable animals. They're as complex as humans, I think, in many ways. They live in social groups where the females all live together in several generations all their lives. Males leave when they get to be 12, 10, 12, 14, and start off their lives as adult males, which are very different. They're quite competitive. The females are very, very cooperative, caring for their own young and each other's young.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Katie Payne. She's a naturalist and the founder of the Elephant Listening Project. Now, you also have mentioned that you witnessed this amazing stillness that you could hear almost as herds of elephants were wandering by. I read that in one of your blogs or something.
Well, every now and then, when you're watching a field full of elephants, each engaged in its own behavior, sometimes what mud bathing or feeding, suddenly you'll see the entire herd, if it's a herd, let's call it an H-E-A-R-D herd, become freeze. I'll become extremely still, ears raised and stiffened. And they may hold this posture. Lots of different ages and sexes and behaviors frozen in time. They hold this posture for up to a minute. And then they may change the behavior or maybe not. But it's a peculiar thing to see. And you say to yourself, these animals are sensing something that I can't sense.
Well, tell us now about how you founded the Elephant Listening Project. It's a world-renowned organization now. It's done some great work.
Thank you. I'm so glad to hear that. Okay, so what 15 or so years went by when I was working with various wonderful collaborators in southern Africa, Zimbabwe, Namibia, and Kenya, trying this way and that way to figure out over what distances elephants were hearing and responding to each other. And was this infrasound, low-frequency sound, in part responsible for their ability to coordinate their social behavior? And yeah, we found out it is. And we found out that males hone in on the calls that fertile females make, and that's how they find one another, even though they live rather separately. After years of that, I became aware, or began to think about what I'd known all along, the fact that there's another species, or maybe subspecies, of elephant that lives in forests. Now, in the forest, you can't see, but you can hear. And the big problem I was also becoming aware of was that elephants are gradually being pushed in the direction of extinction by a competition with humans for resources, and also by trade in ivory, that whole uncomfortable story. I thought, and the poaching is rampant in Central Africa, where the great forest spreads right across the continent. It's the second largest forest in the world. Great, great, marvelous rainforest. People are very poor there, though it's the home of a number of quite poor nations that are full of civil unrest and all kinds of things that make it so they really can't support much wildlife conservation.
Yeah, understandable.
Although they would like to. And I thought, well, gosh, maybe we could use the sounds that elephants make as indicators of where they are and how many they are and what they're doing and whether the populations are healthy. In other words, we could use them as a guide to their conservation.
So that's why you started the project.
So we started the project, and I say we. It was Maya Thompson and Melissa Grew, Eric Spaulding and me, just a little group of people getting started at the Lab of Ornithology. And the equipment that we use was a genius piece, a genius tool put together by Christopher Clark, who is the director of the Bioacoustics Research Program and ought to be on your program because he will answer those stories about whale communication and the sound pollution better than anyone could.
Okay, I will note that.
Yeah. In any case, Chris and his team of engineers had invented a little digital recorder that you can put in a tree or in the ocean, whichever, and it will constantly record for up to 3 months without needing any maintenance. So we realized we could eavesdrop on elephants by distributing a number of these units in the trees and find out all kinds of things about
them. Without disturbing them with your presence.
Without disturbing
their
behavior.
That's the key, isn't it?
It is the key. One of the big problems with animal behavior studies in the world, wild, is that it's very hard to do the study without disturbing what you want to learn about.
Now, I want to talk to you about this. Are we losing the battle to save elephants and their habitats? And let's talk about environmental issues that concern you right now.
We are certainly losing the battle to save normally behaving wild elephants in their natural habitats. That is being changed. In a lot of places, the numbers of elephants are just dwindling. Asian elephants aren't here for very long. There are only something like 30,000 of them left in the world. Forest elephants are relatively numerous, but nobody knows how many. The estimates range tenfold, but there may be a couple hundred thousand forest elephants left in the many Central and West African countries. What threatens them is human behavior, human thinking, human attitudes toward what is valuable and what is important. And why I distinguished between natural behavior and normal wild behavior and something else is that in southern Africa, a number of nations, South Africa, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, have taken the stance that they should have an ivory trade, that they should cull some of the populations that seem too dense, too many elephants for the amount of space that is allotted to them, given the fact that human populations surrounding those spaces are also growing.
What a threat that is.
Well, so you open the ivory trade and you have opened a Pandora's box. Everything it leads to is distortion of elephant populations, distortion of these wonderful, compassionate interactions that the elephants make with each other. And so I'm fiercely against it, although I understand that the problems are not easy to solve. And you asked me for a broader
thing. I know you have some other environmental...
Since I know that some of my listeners will be folks in the Finger Lakes area, I think we have a parallel distortion or controversy when we think about the possible gas drilling in the Finger Lakes area. This, of course, is where I grew up, and I love it passionately for its own natural self and for the farming that people are doing and the peace and quiet. And at the same time, I do not resent poor people needing to make some money and responding to the offers of the gas industry of money in exchange for leasing their land for drilling. But as I've looked into the issue, I've discovered that there's a big farce here. That if the Marcellus Shale in our area was drilled for 30 years, it would produce 1% of the energy that the U.S. uses in 1 year.
Where did you get those statistics? I've heard various.
That's not very much.
The statistics I've heard are always low, but where did you get that statistic from?
On a wonderful website that was made available to me. It's an excellent PowerPoint that was recently given in Grace Church in Elmira, I think on January 28. I forget the name of the man who did it, but people can access it through a website called tcgasmap.org, which is highly responsible and informative.
So this is your new concern for your fellow human beings.
It's a
habitat.
Concern for my fellow human beings, which doesn't mean I feel less concerned about the animals, but we're among those animals.
I want to ask you this too: are you opposed to elephants being used in circuses and in zoos? I mean, there is a movement for many, many years of people saying they don't like seeing animals in captivity at all. Well, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts, I've often been asked about this. My thoughts are that there are very few situations in which elephants should be held captive. But occasionally you find a zoo that is handling them so well that the elephants seem to be very happy. So handling them well means giving them lots of space. It means not keeping males in captivity. I've never seen a happy male. It means allowing females to have relationships with one another and to share the care of calves.
So they should never be held in solitary, that's for sure.
Oh, my God, no. You know, it essentially sort of... Essentially, I think they should not be kept in captivity, but I think that zoos, a good zoo, very well managed and with lots of good information programs is doing such a service to the world, because there are many, many, many people who will never get to see these gorgeous animals except there.
Yeah.
I think people should travel to those very best of all places, and I think zoos should not keep any animals in captivity who can't be totally happy in their social lives.
Yeah. That's well said. Now, how have you applied some of the work you've done for all your life in regard to whales, elephants? Well, what has it actually taught us?
Hey. Well, my children are naturalists. My friends are naturalists. We all like to go outdoors. I'm very worried about the increase of indoor priority in the lives of children now that they can sit in front of screens and play video games, and now that they have much, much less time outdoors just to use in their own whimsical ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a very damaging loss. So I do quite a lot of school teaching at all levels, actually, from pre-K to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And this is part of what I am thinking about.
Yeah. A lot of people are afraid children are losing touch with nature, thinking that they're seeing it on the screen, and it's not the same thing.
It's not at all the same thing. And, of course, more than 50% of the world's population now lives in cities. So we have an opening. We must open ourselves again to something that's incredibly beautiful.
Mm.
And look at it on all scales and at all levels and allow ourselves to realize it's more important than much that we could learn in other places and ways.
Mm-hmm. Katie, we only have about a minute and a half left. Are you working on a new book? I heard that you were, about forest elephants.
Uh-huh. Yes, I am, yes. It's called Mud Bathing with Mastodons. And it takes off from helping to dig up the bones of a mastodon and a mammoth out by Watkins Glen, and then thinking about what this landscape has seen long before it saw humans, and thinking about the fact that those animals went extinct, and that it's entirely up to us whether elephants in Africa and Asia go extinct or not.
Mm-hmm. And when will this book be out?
Oh, I hope within a year.
That's great. Can you give contact information for the Elephant Listening Project?
Yes, elephantlisteningproject.org is a website. The present leader is Peter Regge, W-R-E-G-E, a wonderful biologist, now working in Gabon, where he's listening to the forests, hearing gunshots, hearing elephant voices, and interpreting both for the good of conservation practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, Katie Payne, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for all the work you've done. It's magnificent what you've done.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.